The next passage, and this is reading, this is Alice Miller's For Your Own Good. The next passage by J.G. Kruger reveals why it was and still is so important to pedagogues to combat obstinacy vigorously. Quote, "It is my view that one should never strike children for offenses they commit out of weakness. The only vice deserving of blows is obstinacy. It is therefore wrong to strike children at their lessons, wrong to strike them for falling down, wrong to strike them for crying, right and proper to strike them for all of these transgressions, and for even more trivial ones if they have committed them out of wickedness. If your son does not want to learn because it is your will, if he cries with the intent of defying you, if he does harm in order to offend you, in short, if he insists on having his own way, then whip him well till he cries so, 'Oh no, Papa, oh no.' Such disobedience amounts to a declaration of war against you. Your son is trying to usurp your authority." And my comment, here is a good expression of Bentham's point, that the parent is the manifestation in the home of the state. The parent is the state, and the state is a Cronus, requires that its children be crippled, stripped of will, of authentic selves, so the master's will can be inserted in them. That's Bentham's whole reason to be, defining the logic of the will that you then insert in the children. Continuing with Mr. Kruger, "And you are justified if your child has declared war on you. You are justified in answering force with force in order to ensure his respect." You know, recall our reading last week from Samuel Butler, and how much respect for his father did those beatings instill in him. And then he goes on, skip, skip, skip. "If children are educated with befitting prudence at a young age, then surely it will very rarely be necessary to torture your children. But it can't be avoided, however, if one takes children in to be reared after they've already developed a will of their own. But sometimes, especially when they are of a proud nature, one can, even in the case of serious transgressions, dispense with beatings if one makes them, for example, go barefoot and hungry and serve at table, or otherwise inflicts pain upon them where it hurts." Yeah, these power guys are big on punishment. Bentham explained why, right? How can you rule? How can you govern unless you punish the disobedient? So this is now Alice's reply. "Here, everything is stated openly still. In modern books on child rearing, the authors carefully mask their emphasis on the importance of gaining control over the child. Over the years, a sophisticated repertory of arguments was developed to prove the necessity of corporal punishment for the child's own good. In the 18th century, however, one still spoke freely of usurping authority, of faithful subjects, etc. And this language reveals the sad truth, which unfortunately still holds today. For parents' motives are the same today as they were then. In beating their children, they are struggling to regain the power they once lost to their own parents. For the first time, they see the vulnerability of their own earliest years, which they are unable to recall, reflected in their children. Only now, when someone weaker than they is involved, do they finally fight back, often quite fiercely. There are countless rationalizations still used today to justify their behavior. Although parents always mistreat their children for psychological reasons, i.e., because of their own needs, there is a basic assumption in our society that this treatment is good for children. Last but not least, The pains that are taken to defend this line of reasoning betray its dubious nature. The arguments used contradict every psychological insight we've gained. Yet they are passed on from generation to generation. There must be an explanation for this that has deep emotional roots in all of us underclass. It is unlikely that someone could proclaim truths that are counter to physical laws for very long. For example, that it's healthy for children to run around in bathing suits in winter and in fur coats in summer without appearing ridiculous. But it's perfectly normal to speak of the necessity of striking and humiliating children and robbing them of their autonomy. At the same time, using such high-sounding words as chastising, upbringing, and guiding onto the right path. The excerpts from Schwartz's Pädagogik, which follow, which we'll read next week, indicate how much a parent's hidden, unrecognized needs stand to profit from such an ideology. This also explains the great resistance to accepting and integrating the indisputable body of knowledge about psychological principles that has been built up in recent decades. There are many good books available describing the harmful and cruel aspects of traditional methods of child rearing. And she cites von Bruch, von Bronmuhl, Lloyd de Mos, Katharina Rutschke, Morten Schatzman, Katharina Zimmer, to mention a few. Why has all this information brought about so little change in the attitudes of the public at large? And my comment on this. But add the fact that power acts clandestinely to maintain this way of things. That all for them depends on capturing and controlling human energy, on convincing us that we are workers, and the puzzle is solved. We're going to be continuing to think through the ways in which this stripping us of self and how this process is captured in equivalencies across the system globally, and that reclaiming our true self is reclaiming three-phase power. And thank you if any of you stayed on board through all of that silence and technical difficulties. I'm very grateful for those who hung in there and for those who listen, period. Until next week, peace.